This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Good afternoon. I'm not Steve Shoemaker, but he is one of the guests on Keeping the Faith today, along with frequent guest host Don Nolan. And today's topic is, who are these hosts of Keeping the Faith, that is? I'm Stan Yanchis, longtime listener and occasional guest host. I am not, however, as advertised, a Parkland College professor, although I am a proud alum of Parkland and have taught there part-time over the years. I taught English, public speaking, and creative writing at Centennial High School for 2 years, and now am pleased to be joining Steve and Don as emeritus status in much of what I do. What we're going to try to do today is learn a little bit more about Steve and Don, and listeners are, as always, very welcome to join in the questioning, in this case, of the questionnaires. So please give us a call at 217-333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Or if it's a long-distance call, use 1-800-222-9455. And now let's find out a little bit more about Steve and Don. Steve, many of Keeping the Faith's listeners know that you, in addition to your work here, were for many years a minister at McKinley Presbyterian, and then director of the university YMCA. But I'd like to go back a little further than that, maybe back to childhood, and get a little idea of your growing up and maybe your educational background. And finally, how did you get here to Champaign-Urbana?
Well, the last part is easy. I was born here. I was born in Urbana years ago in Carl's Hospital. And in fact, my father was born in Champaign-Urbana. My grandfather moved here from Alney, Illinois, in the 1930s and started a construction company and later felt the call to the ministry and was ordained in a Baptist church, although he'd never been to college or seminary. But he started his own church in North Urbana and preached there for 25 years, and that's where I grew up. My parents went there. And so I'm a longtime Urbana person. I went to graduated from Urbana High School, and then I left. I was gone from the Twin Cities for 20 years. I went to college and seminary in Chicago, and then my PhD came from Duke University in North Carolina, and we lived there for 12 years, my wife Nadja and I. I met Nadja in Urbana High School, so we both have roots here.
Okay, so although you were away for 20 years, you made it back home, so you're a townie returned home. Now, Don, I do know for certain, however, that you're not a native of Champaign-Urbana. So a little bit about your childhood, your educational background, and how you ended up here in Champaign-Urbana.
No, I am an alien. and I am very concerned about admitting that I do come from the nation of Texas. Mm-hmm. Would-be nation. I grew up in Dallas, Texas, met my wife at Baylor University where we got our degrees, BA and master's degree, and came here for graduate work. And after a while discovered that Steve Shoemaker was a eloquent and articulate minister that attracted us, and we joined McKinley Foundation Presbyterian Church.
Oh, we'll get a chance to talk about that a little later. Steve, maybe we'll just take when you were at the McKinley Presbyterian as pastor and later on at the YMCA, what were some of the activities that brought you about town, and where else might people know you from other than just those direct professional experiences?
Well, it was a joy to be a pastor at McKinley Presbyterian Church, partly because the community there was very concerned about being involved in the larger community. And so I was very pleased when they voted, for example, to welcome the homeless shelter for homeless men back in the early 80s, 82, I think it was, to find a home there when there was no other place for homeless men to be in the community. And so in the basement of the church, they opened that up, and eventually we had as many as 75 men there overnight, and then eventually during the day some too in the winter months, before there was enough money to gathered together to start the to actually build a building. Mm-hmm. And so that's, I was very proud of that. But the church was also involved in many other things, a mission to the Yucatan Peninsula led by co-pastor Charlie Schweitzer, Jack Dial, taking students to do work projects, spring break, summer break in Mexico. So the community was involved in a lot of things. There was a place there still is, where people can go and get free clothes,
right,
called Scott Free. So it was a very active congregation, very active in the community. It was open to gays and lesbians early on. Before that was a very popular thing to do. And so I was very proud to be associated.
And brought a lot of people in the community, I remember, together from different organizations and from different churches, and together, and certainly played a major role.
It did try to be very ecumenical, and we cooperated with other Christian denominations, Catholics as well as Protestants, with Hillel Foundation across the street for Jewish students, with the mosque after it became, in fact, we McKinley Foundation was the home for Muslims in this community before they built the mosque on Lincoln Avenue.
Right. It was also a More Light church.
That's right.
So I think we're already, our listeners are finding out some things they don't know. And speaking of listeners, we do have a call on line one. And I don't have the location, but why don't we just go ahead and take that call?
A listener, are you there?
Hello.
Yes, go right ahead.
I live in Urbana. And
okay.
I must tell you that I do enjoy listening to this program most of the time, and I've learned a lot. But the one thing I need to learn now is why you used the theme song that you used, the theme music.
Well, that's a story I can repeat. Before this, the very first time this program went on the air, back in 1999, the station manager at that time said, well, you need to come up with some kind of a music theme that'll be distinctive, and why don't you pick something out that you like? And I happen to like jazz, and I knew a young jazz saxophone player who'd just come out with his very first CD, named John Ellis. And so I picked a piece from that I liked, and used that at the beginning and the end of each show ever since. He has since become a rather well-known jazz saxophonist. If you look him up, you'll see that he has now several CDs and has played all over the world. So that's John Ellis, tenor sax.
All right, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you, caller. Don, I think, again, as I mentioned, and many people in town here know you as a professor of religion and philosophy out at Parkland College for many, many years. I, for one, and of many, one of your students. Tell us a little bit about your career out of Parkland, some of the things that you did out there, the nature of your classes, some of the things that you were involved in.
Well, we have had a program out there since the beginning of the college. It features virtually all of the basic undergraduate courses, introduction to logic and critical thinking, introduction to philosophy, ethics, religious studies. We've had a course in healthcare ethics at one time, business and organizational ethics, computer ethics. We also teach world religions, religions of the East, religions of the West, and it's been one of the more viable, vigorous, well-attended programs in the state of Illinois. I understand at one point in time the enrollment there was second or third in the state. I don't know where it stands now that I've been retired, but I've been doing that for a long time.
Yeah, and a very popular program. As I said, I was one of your students, and you first introduced me to Buddha, among many many other mm-hmm. things, and enlightening. You always were full of many interesting facts, such as Buddha dying after eating some soup.
Food poisoning.
Which didn't seem necessarily to be of the highest order. You know, I asked Steve about some of the other things that he did in Champaign and Urbana, and I was wondering if you might share a little bit with our listeners perhaps some of your interest outside of your professional teaching out at Parkland.
Are you talking to me?
I am talking to you still.
Organized a few conferences out at Parkland on a variety of subjects, liberal arts and critical thinking, and several interfaith conferences that we had. Steve was involved in several of these, particularly right after 9/11 for a period of time. I suppose the most notable event outside of Parkland was my tenure on the Champaign School Board for about 12 years.
And the last session, I believe you were the president of the school board for...
Four or five years,
and that was certainly a tremendous contribution to make because that was a somewhat controversial time, and there was a great deal of things going on, and many people credited you with bringing a voice of reason into some very, very emotional issues, and I know the community appreciated that.
Whatever mistakes happened are because of Steve. He twisted my arm to run.
Well, I remember having a sign in my yard for you, and also I used to – one of the things I like to brag about, that I think I was the only person in town that had a sign, that supported both you and another sign supporting Nicole Storch, for our listeners, was a very involved lady also in our community. Well, this is a show about faith, spirituality, and religion and ethics, so maybe we should move a little bit in that direction. Now, Steve, you alluded that you were indeed brought up in a somewhat conservative Christian home, and your work at the McKinley Presbyterian, some people might consider a liberal Protestant movement. Could you share a little bit about the scope of that journey?
I've heard left-wing pinko, if I can just say that.
Well, I did grow up in a church called the Northside Gospel Center, where, as I mentioned, my grandfather was a pastor. It was sort of like an independent Baptist church, and it was very conservative. In fact, a fundamentalist rather than evangelical, I would say. There were a lot of things we were brought up, me and my three brothers, younger brothers, were brought up to not do. We were not to drink alcohol or smoke tobacco or dance or go to movies or the theater. And that was the women in that church didn't wear jewelry or makeup generally. So there was a lot of things that were very fundamentalist Christian. When I was... in high school, my parents lived in Champaign for part of my growing up years, so I went to Champaign grade schools in junior high, and I can remember in junior high that the kids from our church and a few other fundamentalist churches were taught to carry a Bible to church with or to school with us, and to carry it always on top of our books, and to show, to make sure people would notice that. We were often given red leather Bibles to carry, or New Testaments. And so you can imagine what it was like in a typical middle school or junior high to be sort of advertising your faith that way. This was something that I accepted at the time, and I thought it made a certain amount of sense given what we'd been taught. But when I went to college, things began to change.
Now, was this at Duke or was this your undergrad?
My undergraduate, I went to Wheaton College. And,
right, that's what I thought.
And my parents,
which is a fairly conservative Christian school.
It's also very,
right.
At the time was fairly fundamentalist, but my parents considered Wheaton rather liberal. they would have preferred me to go to Bob Jones University or Moody Bible Institute, neither of which were accredited. Colleges at that time.
Wheaton, for some of our listeners, Wheaton being described as liberal may be a sentence they haven't heard before.
I know, it's very strange.
Just recently here, it hasn't been too long, they had the dancing controversy.
That's right. They finally allowed dancing at Wheaton. But at any rate, that's where I began to question what I'd been brought up to think. And I started attending a few other congregations. And I chose the Presbyterian denomination when I was in Wheaton College, because at the time, the Presbyterian Church was very active in anti-Vietnam War activities, was very strong in supporting Martin Luther King in terms of civil rights, and was concerned with fighting poverty. And those were concerns that made sense to me as a Christian. And so I made that choice during college, and then I went to a very liberal, progressive Presbyterian seminary in Chicago called McCormick. And so I guess I've been I would identify myself as a progressive Protestant Christian ever since.
And so the social issues played a big role in becoming active in what you're doing. Now, Don, if we can move over you a little bit, I think your journey is somewhat similar. I believe you had mentioned before the show that you were a Southern Baptist. Is that correct? And you
correct.
And since you come up to Champaign, Urbana, you are now have been a member of the McKinley Presbyterian congregation, mm-hmm. And I think that this somewhere for some reason that before the show I mentioned even it floated in my mind that you had attended at times some Unitarian which
attended
mm-hmm. Some people might even consider a little left of the Presbyterians in terms of that. So share with us a little bit how this journey occurred.
I'm not sure the Unitarian Church is left of McKinley, but we can talk about that later.
All right.
I grew up with a religious consciousness as a teenager in a small Southern Baptist fundamentalist church in Dallas, Texas, Oak Cliff, for those who know the area. When I left there, I spent 1 year at East Texas Baptist College and discovered that the highlight of the year, if you know anything about East Texas, Marshall, Texas, is a very interesting place in the history of the civil rights movement. Bill Moyers is from there, and James Farmer, and ex-president of Parkland College, Zalima Harris. Very interesting area. But the highlight of the year at East Texas was young white boys, undergraduate boys, going around collecting outhouses of African-American families and putting them on the football field as a bonfire for homecoming. And I found this to be highly problematic, and this was about the same time as the civil rights movement was taking off and develop a budding sense of social justice and awareness, and decided this was not the place for me, and went to Baylor University and got into religious studies and philosophy, and first read William James' The Varieties of Religious Experiences, which turned my head more than any other as a young undergraduate, and I finally came to the realization that pastoring two as an interim pastor, even though I was in my early 20s, I was a spiritual teenager pastoring two little country churches. I realized that this was not the direction I was going to go in, and decided to pursue a graduate degree in teaching philosophy. So I don't know where you want to take it from there.
Well, no, I think that gives us a pretty good idea, but I...
Stan, I might interrupt.
Steve has a comment here.
Stan, I might interrupt and just say when Don was teaching philosophy at Parkland, at one point he and I were talking about there not being religion courses offered there at that time, and we investigated and found out that there was only one of the community colleges in the state, College of DuPage, that was offering religion courses, and Don got me approved to teach one course a semester out at Parkland in religion. And so some people may remember me from days when I taught at Parkland just part-time. I was always full-time at either McKinley Church or the University of Y, but both places felt it was appropriate for me to be teaching one course a semester. And so I taught at Parkland a number of years, and then I also taught at the University of Illinois in the Department of Religion at Illinois, again, just one course a semester, particularly when they would have a faculty member who'd be on sabbatical or need somebody to teach New Testament or Introduction to the Bible. Or for several years I taught a course called Christianity, Literature, and the Arts, where we looked at Christian themes in both visual arts and architecture and in literature.
Yeah, and I know you also did some less formal educational classes, because I came over to the McKinley Foundation and we had a lunch group that was faith in writers, putting faith into your writing, and had a really an eclectic group of people, and it was absolutely delightful taking a look at spirituality in fiction and poetry, and Some people may not know that you yourself are a poet. You've written a fair amount of poetry. Did you want to mention anything about that?
Well, it's something I've always enjoyed doing from high school on, actually. I've written poetry, and I've been fortunate to have some of it published in some interesting places. I'm proudest, I suppose, that I had a poem published in the journal Judaism. Mm-hmm. Not many Christian pastors can say that, and not many Protestant pastors can say they've had poetry published in the National Catholic Reporter.
Right,
I have had that, and as well as in the Christian Century and other places. But I mainly write religious poetry. And I might mention, you ask what else I do. I enjoy teaching at OLLI, the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute. Since I've retired, my wife and I enjoy taking classes there here in Champaign-Urbana. I've also taught courses and coordinated courses where I brought in speakers to speak about Islam, for example. Right now I'm teaching a course on C.S. Lewis. It's about to come to an end, just two more sessions, but I enjoy teaching.
And one of the things that Don and you both do share is a sense of modesty. I, as you're aware, I'm in that class on C.S. Lewis, and you are, as advertised by OLLI, one of the most popular instructors out there, and there must be in this particular course 40 or 50 people. I mean, it closed very, very quickly.
And, I'm not completely modest. There are 55 in the class.
When everyone's present. All right. And Don, also, you know, Steve mentioned you bringing him out to teach classes and the significant role that you played at Parkland in expanding religious courses being offered. I mean, you also brought out some other pretty renowned scholars. Rabbi Newman here locally was out and taught at times and mm-hmm. some other people. So I have a question that may cause you to ponder for a minute, and that would be, would you describe yourself then as in terms professionally, were you a theological philosopher or were you a philosophical theologian?
Some would say never the twain shall meet. There is such thing as philosophy of religion. I think I would put myself in that category, not a theologian.
Okay. Let me, by the way, again.
By the way, we had three rabbis and two pastors teach religion courses out there.
Oh, I know. You had again, an abundance, and I thought that was something that is was certainly a trademark of your professional reputation, is to look at all perspectives and to offer a variety of viewpoints on various things, and you certainly professionally live that and personally as well. I did want to encourage our callers again, if there's anything, whether it is about their personal or professional background, to give us a call if you have any questions for Steve Shoemaker, the regular host. We're going to talk a little bit more about the show, how it came into being here shortly, or Don Nolan, regular guest host, and those numbers again are locally 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. And if you are listening long distance, you can call in at 1-800-222-9455. And so I think that we'll stay, and perhaps I think we have a few more minutes here till the break. In the spiritual domain, and you both have given us an idea of your own journeys, and I think that your concerns for social justice played certainly a role in your own spiritual journey. So I would like to ask, and Steve, I'll start with you, what were some of the more difficult spiritual questions that you personally struggled over with the years and may even still be struggling with?
Well, they're innumerable. Like all people who think about their own faiths, you wonder, first of all, how is what I believe and practice connected with what other people believe and practice? And that's one of the reasons I found this radio show to be a wonderful opportunity to find out what other people actually think and do. So that's a major issue, of course. I also, of course, naturally think about Why is there so much violence in the world? Why so much poverty? Why so much suffering? The whole problem of pain, the problem of evil. I think people of any theistic belief, mm-hmm. if you think there's a God, that's good and loving and powerful? Why are we
suffering?
Why does all this happen? So that continually is something I think a lot of people worry about, think about. I also am trying to be in dialogue with people who have no belief, no faith, agnostics, atheists, and try to hear them clearly and what their concerns are and see what we have in common. Often we can agree on ethics. Often we can agree on social issues. But we have major disagreements about, is there a God or not? Is there a God that's real? So those are some of the things.
But it is still possible. It is possible to have disagreements and be civil. I think you do an excellent job on this show, and sometimes when I see other media outlets and discussions on religion, spirituality going on in the world, I would say, boy, wouldn't it be nice if Steve Shoemaker could just be on there for a little while to bring some civility to that discussion. So, and I know that I mentioned that because I know I've heard that comment regarding your show from others as well. Don, I'd like to throw that same question to you, spiritual questions that you've struggled with over the years.
Well, I've always been interested in religion. And at a period in my life when I tried to overcome the incoherence that often follows young persons who are struggling with the shortcomings of fundamentalism and literalism, I entered a Marxist, secularist, materialist stage in my own thinking and values, and finally came to the realization that there were shortcomings there as well. So I have been intrigued with the question, how do you reconcile with religion and keep a sense of integrity? How do you reconcile with your own tradition? I've always been impressed by Houston Smith, who is the often touted dean of world religion studies. He was born in China, Methodist missionaries, came back to the United States, got his degree in philosophy and religious studies, became eventually the chair of the Department of Philosophy at MIT, traveled the world and took every discipline and every study and experienced every religious tradition. To an extent, I don't know of anybody that has ever done that before. Even Alan Watts did not do that. And he said near the end of his career, to Bill Moyers, actually, he said that he wants to be buried in a Methodist seminary. And
why?
He was asked the question why, and he said, well, my experiences in my full and rich life have enlarged and expanded my soul, but I was born a Methodist and I will die a Methodist. And there's a sense of loyalty there. And so a good part of my spiritual quest has been what do I owe Southern Baptists? What do I owe the culture I grew up in? I've had some conversations with Larry Greenfield about that. That's one big one. And the other one is trying to understand what the collective wisdom is of the enduring world religions. And I think I've gotten to a point in my life where I have a pretty good fix on that.
Well, maybe we can get back to that a little more with that. And then I do have a question for both of you regarding some of the trends, if you will, in current religious beliefs. But first, I think I want to give Steve a moment or two to make a few announcements.
You are listening to Keeping the Faith, and I want to thank Stan Yanchis, who's being the host today, for doing this. This program was his idea. He approached me, and it had been suggested before, particularly about us, Don and me, being interviewed and letting people ask us questions. And Dale Robb, a retired pastor who's in town, had suggested this some years ago, and I put him off. I just thought, well, I'm not sure how interesting that would be. But when Stan mentioned it this time, I thought, well, we'll just go with it. And since Stan had hosted this program before and knew how to do all these electronic things here in the studio, I thought, well, we'll just do it. So I want to thank Stan for hosting today and for the idea of this program. You are listening to WILL AM 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3. And this program is also heard online, of course, at will.illinois.edu/AM live and /keepingthefaith if you want to hear archive programs. Go to will.illinois.edu/keepingthefaith. Coming up on Keeping the Faith in the weeks ahead, next week, Church World Service, the Hunger Program, will be the point of discussion. The local crop walks will be highlighted. Nikki Kyle, Anthony Stouter will be our guests on March 18. Jay Michelson, who was supposed to be on the show a couple of weeks ago but had a conflict at the very last minute, will be talking with us by phone. He keeps assuring me every week, yes, I really will be here there this time on the phone. And we'll be talking about the religious case for gay rights. Jay Michelson is the author of the book, came out last year, God versus Gay? He grew up in a Jewish family and is we'll be talking from a Jewish perspective on that issue. He spoke here on campus at Hillel just a few weeks ago. We'll be talking about safe zones in schools in Kenya with Professor Esther Portnoy on March 25th. Later in April, we'll be hearing from a number of people. Josh Slocum, who is the National Executive Director of the Funeral Consumers Association. We'll be learning about earth care from Catherine Cusmull and David Sherwood of the Church in Urbana. We'll be hearing from Jackie Lynn, who's the National Director of the Episcopal Peace Fellowship. Axel Gehrman will be talking about worship from his perspective as a Unitarian pastor. We'll be talking about the Wall Street protests. That's on April 29. Joan Bailey will be our guest in May 6, talking about exciting ways to teach adult Sunday school classes. And the one I really want to highlight is April 22nd, though. Roger Ebert, we're going to play an archive program from 1999, before the very first Ebert Film Festival here in Champaign-Urbana at the Virginia Theater. Roger talked with us by phone about religious themes in movies. And since has lost his voice due to cancer over the last several years, it'll be good to hear his voice again. So we're going to be playing that long-lost program from 99 with film critic Roger Ebert on April 22nd, right before the Ebert Fest this spring. Two quick announcements. The local Hindu community is finally starting construction on their long-anticipated temple, which will be out on North Mattis Avenue, north of Champaign. They're having a fundraising dinner February 17, St. Patrick's Day evening, 6 p.m. at the I Hotel. It's a fundraising dinner, so you'll get entertainment and a grand feast of Indian food and Eastern food for $100. So if you'd like to do that, there's a phone number I'm going to give now. It's 217-367-1160 to get information, to get tickets. That's to support the new Hindu temple construction dinner on the 17th March 17, St. Patrick's Day. $100 a ticket at the I Hotel with fascinating entertainment and great food. Call 217-367-1160. And Val Kopal will talk to you on the phone and help you get tickets to that event. Coming up at the University Y that has supported this program for many years, on Friday Forum, coming up this next week, Robert McKim, professor of religion and philosophy at the University of Illinois, former head of that department, comparing religions. He'll be talking about on March 9 at the Friday Forum at the University Y at the University of Illinois on the corner of Chalmers and Wright Street. That's at noon. It's a free lecture and part of the series at the Y this semester on creative approaches to global development. So those are my announcements, Stan.
All right. Thank
you,
Steve.
Putting you back in charge, and I see we have a caller.
Thank you. We do indeed have a caller from Champaign on line one who's been very patient through all those announcements. So, caller, go ahead.
The announcements are important, but can you tell me why the floating of religious symbols, you mentioned carrying the Red Bible or whatever to class, and there's several others like that, which only, as far as I can see, tend to promote intolerance. And then also, how do you teach people to tolerate intolerance? And I'll just listen on radio.
Thank you. Steve?
Well, I think several religions have a belief that it's important to let other people know what they believe, and particularly religious groups that feel that they have something important to share. And sometimes it can be annoying, and sometimes it may be welcome. And I think it's a hard call. If you don't think what you do and believe is important, why are you doing it? And if you think it's important, wouldn't you want to share it with someone else? But on the other hand, you want to respect their independence, their dignity, their own beliefs and practices, if they have any. So it's a difficult issue. And, of course, in many traditions, there have been missionaries, there have been evangelists who've gone out to share what they believe is good news, truth, something helpful. Of course, there's a whole other tradition that says we speak best when we don't speak at all, but let people see what we do. So I think there's a tension between those two approaches, and maybe some go too far one way and others go too far the other.
Okay, thank you, Steve. Don, comment?
I'm curious. You didn't address his last comment, Steve.
Tolerance, yeah.
You
go first. And then
tolerating the intolerant? Was that the caller's
statement? I think so. You go first, and then I'll correct your mistakes.
let me just associate myself with you're carrying a Bible around in high school. I did the same thing. I don't think it was what'd you say? You had a white one?
Red.
Red. I had a black Bible with lots of tabs in it. I think that the comment about tolerating intolerance is complex. In a pluralistic society, there are going to be intolerant factions of that society, and a healthy society attempts to find a place of accommodation for that. In the United States, there has been a longstanding tradition of separation of church and state, which has been highly tenuous and highly contested and controversial. And there have been plenty of intolerant traditions that have grown up in this country, and they continue to spill out onto the public scene. I think most specifically the comment by a conservative radio commentator who recently accused a third-year law student at Georgetown of being a slut because she was speaking before Congress in favor of birth control as part of a health care program. So we have that. I think that there are some forms of intolerance which are intolerable and others that need to be accommodated simply for the purpose of understanding the wider spectrum of opinion. To respond to intolerance with a strong hand usually creates negative consequences. I'm just now focusing on Jainism in my World Religions of the East class, and the Jains, probably of all of the world's religions, are the most tolerant of all of the great religious traditions. And I'm impressed by the general idea that in Jainism that it is a form of violence to deny people their religious expression. And at some point you have to come to terms with matters of self-defense and survival if the intolerance spills out into more dangerous ways, and that's always a matter of controversy. So the caller's comment was, I think, very complicated.
Yes. And has been and will continue to be. So Steve, you were going to either correct or add to?
No, I think that states it very well. Thank you, Don.
Okay. One thing I might note is this show in of itself is one place where you allow and encourage many voices to be heard. Just during your announcements, for example, you had shared a gathering of Hindus that was thing, and as you advertised your future guest, you have a Jewish speaker coming on, and that seems to be something that you've tried to make a point of the show. And so when we get into the taking a little deeper look at how guests are selected and topics are selected for the show, you might want to come back to some of the purposes behind that one. But I did bring one question that I wanted to throw out the two of you this week in not a scholarly magazine now, worthy of the two of your academic backgrounds, but a popular one-time magazine's 10 ideas, 10 most important ideas. Number four was titled Nuns, N-O-N-E-S, Nuns, and took a look at some current religious trends, one of which is people who are disassociated themselves from all organized religion, yet are seeking out spirituality and moving towards some sort of understanding. I wish I had brought the magazine, but I was hurrying to review over the technical stuff that so I didn't forget and disappoint Steve here. So I don't know. Don, you're nodding, so you may have. Did you have a chance to see that, or have you heard the reference to it?
12% now in the United States, as I understand it, right?
It was even higher than that. And I can't, again, I'm sorry for not bringing the magazine. If anybody has it handy out there and wants to call and tell us the exact percentage. But what do you think of that? Is this a healthy trend? Is it a spiritual trend? Is it reflecting on organized religion, perhaps going back to this caller's concerns about tolerance or
right.
intolerance? What do you think?
Again, there are a number of factors. I think a lot of the people who are interviewed in this country about why they don't state an allegiance to a organized religious tradition, whom Time magazine calls nuns, N-O-N-E-S, by the way, in case callers want to know what you mean by nuns, that
right.
means that none of the above.
Right.
Many of them report that the reason they do this is because they're dissatisfied with the politicization of religion, both within traditions. There's so much bickering over, for example, homosexuality and abortion within traditions and across traditions and within the public square. By the way, nuns, as I understand it, are the fastest growing demographic across the world. Secularization is spreading across the world. It's spreading rapidly in India, I understand, for example.
And yet, what the article did go on to mention was that people are not rejecting
no.
spirituality. They're, in fact, I think the percentage of the 12% was what they gave
right.
as a total for atheists or agnostics.
The paradox
in the
is
country.
That 95 to, depending on what poll you look at, 95 to 98% say they believe in God and have religious values, then how come 12% or more are nuns? And the answer is they're looking for alternative ways to satisfy their spiritual needs.
And I know some would respond to that by saying that faith may not necessarily be a relative choice, that there are some universals, and that personal faith certainly it can be a movement toward God, toward a universal deity. But that if it remains a personal faith, it's not a faith. And Steve, what do you think? Can you weigh in here?
Well, having spent most of my professional career on university campuses, North Carolina State University, where I had my first position as a campus pastor for 8 years, and then now ever since 1981 here at the University of Illinois, I've seen and talked with young people who are going through these decision processes about what they believe and what they don't. And, of course, it's natural as an adolescent to question what you were brought up to believe. And so you expect that's happening in late high school, college years. But it's been interesting over in the last 40 years, seeing how that's changed for college students, for example. And there are many more who end up questioning and who may end up, not making a decision personally for years to actually follow any religious practice, and yet they say they're spiritual. Mm. And as Don says, the polls show many of them say, yes, we believe there's a God. And I think part of that is a criticism of traditional religious practices. I think that makes a lot of, as many churches and synagogues are discovering, and probably mosques as well, many young people are choosing not to affiliate, and that causes deep worries. Where that's going to end is anybody's guess.
Was Don mentioned when he spoke of our caller's comment about tolerance and tolerating intolerance? It's a very complex issue that we could certainly spend a lot of time, and I know you have quite a few guests on that delve into that more, and hopefully in the future we'll see that. But I did want to make sure that we got into the show, a little bit of the history of the show, and because I know people are indeed curious. So can you share with us the genesis of the show? You are the founder, and how did this show come into being? Whose idea was it?
Well, I'll confess it was my idea. as I was listening in the late 90s, mid-90s, regularly to All Things Considered and other programs on WILL and other public broadcasting stations, it seems like they were avoiding talking about religious issues. And as someone who at the time was teaching religion, I knew there was a lot of interest in it. The University of Illinois had a Department of Religion or program for the study of religions at that time. I suppose it had been going on 25 years. But there wasn't on the public airwaves very much, except you heard a lot of very conservative folks who had the money to buy time. You heard them all the time. And so I felt that what was being heard nationally was very skewed towards mm-hmm. very conservative, very right-wing voices when it came to talking about religion and values and ethics and so on. So I approached WILL, and they heard the idea that there might be a weekly program that would deal with these issues, and they said, well, give us a sample. So I interviewed a couple folks, and then said, well, let's try it for 6 months and see if anybody listens. And
been on the air how long now?
Started in 99, in April of 99. And frankly, I think after September 11, 2001, it became obvious to everybody in this country that religious beliefs really did have a whole lot, mattered a whole lot. And the first couple of years, I'm not sure there was widespread appreciation of this particular show, although the numbers kept growing. But since then, it gets a very good listenership. People, the station checks that on with Arbitron ratings locally, and so we know a lot of people listen to the show, and so that's how it began.
Thank you. Now, Don, my first association with being on the show, not as a listener, came from you when you called me in somewhat of a harried state for yourself because you were scheduled to guest for Steve, who was unavailable to get back and to make changes, and the backup was not available, and you had an airplane, as I remember, to board in about 45 minutes, and the show was going to come on, and so your state of desperation was very high, and hence the call to me.
And we made the mistake and called you.
No, you were desperate. Well, I was the last call. But question I want to ask you is, that was my experience, and it was a very enjoyable one. Actually, that was a controversial guest somewhat at the time.
Who was that?
And the publisher from Paxton.
Herb Stevenson. Herb Stevenson.
It was a delightful interview, and it was a wonderful experience and a tremendous social activist.
But he was suing the local school board at the time.
He was suing the school board, a very controversial man who loved controversy. So I always wondered if the two of you kind of belled on. But it was a great experience. But what were your first memories of your connection to the show? When did Steve get a hold of you?
Well, I've been listening
to Steve since the beginning, but I think the first time I was on the show, about 30 seconds before airtime, I get a call 12 miles away that I think you're a guest was unavailable, couldn't show, you couldn't connect or something, and Steve calls me up and he says, Don, you have the gift of the gab, and I know you like to talk about religion and nonstop. Can you come in? And I said, sure. And I got here on time and had a enjoyable session with Steve.
And you've been on many times.
He was a guest. That was the first time he was a guest, but we've had him as a guest since, and he's been a guest host many times.
Many times.
Mm-hmm. So,
well, Steve, mentioning guest, I know one of the things I wonder is Shoemaker out there, and he just kind of, what do I feel like talking about this week? How do you decide on topics and guests? Do you get any input from others, or is this all you, or how are the selections made?
Well, I am the the producer of the show as well as the host.
And you are the decider,
and so I do. I do try to find guests, and you know, I'm a volunteer at all this. I've never been paid, and never asked to be paid. And
you once let me do that twice, and I nearly ended the show and brought down the university.
Well, Don has found guests too when he's been the host. We have had some very controversial guests, very interesting guests. But
why don't go ahead and share a few? We mentioned Herb Stevenson, my first guest. Any that fly into your imagination at the moment?
Well, we've had some even this semester who've created quite consternation in some circles. But one thing that's good about the show is that people can call up and join the conversation immediately. And often, if people object strongly to one person who we have as a guest, I'll say, well, would you like to be a guest yourself and talk about that issue? Because I think that's what makes the show interesting. There are varieties of opinions on a lot of these things, and I think it helps just to talk about them. As you say, we try to have people not yell at one another, and we can't use certain words on the radio, so we don't want them swearing. But we do have strong disagreements between callers and guests, and between one guest one week and one guest another week. I try not to encourage people to call up and say, I want to be on your show, because I have a hard time finding a way to sort of vet them, to find out if they'd be good or not. So we tend to go with authors. We tend to go with people who have a certain reputation. We tend to go with people who are public in their faith in some way, so that they have a reputation that can sort of be, we can find out about.
But you have free rein. WOL doesn't say, hey, this is, we've got a guest.
I've never felt any censorship from WOL. So I think that shows what kind of a place this is.
Well, since Don, let me go back to Don for a minute, because I think our listeners have probably picked up that Don enjoys a certain degree of agitation. And that, Don, are there any future guests or topics that you'd like to challenge Steve to take a look at? Anybody you'd like to hear on the show?
I've actually mentioned a couple. He's urged me to try to locate them, and I hadn't had a chance. One is Chris Hedges, who is a Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times writer, spent a lot of time covering the war in Bosnia, and was urged. Well, it was clear that he would have to resign from the New York Times when he gave a speech at a university condemning the war in Iraq. And so he saw the handwriting on the wall, and since then began writing a whole series of books. He's also had notable debates with people like Dan Dennett, Christopher Hitchens, the two of the three New Atheists. I'd like to see Chris Hedges on, and the other would be James Carroll, Constantine Sword, which I think is one of the most important books on how to rethink Christianity in the West. He wrote, the title of the book is about Constantine, the emperor who made Christianity the official religion of the Roman Empire, among other things. And he, James Carroll, grew up during the Vietnam era and His father was one of the generals who supplied information about Vietnam, and he was involved in Bay of Pigs and finally became disillusioned with becoming a lawyer and went to become a priest and joined with Daniel Berrigan and others protesting the Vietnam War.
I think I'd like to second that last guest here.
The book is a very, very powerful
book. Don has total freedom to try to get him. I'll tell listeners one difficulty. There's a time you can get authors, and then there's a whole lot of time you can't. When they're writing their next book, they don't want to be talking about their last book, usually. And so there's only that time when they're out there sort of promoting the book they've just finished, when they're willing to spend an hour talking to you, even if it's promoting their own work.
Right.
So, so it's not always easy. Sometimes you can get people and sometimes you can't.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to really take a moment here before I turn this back over to you, Steve, to thank you for the opportunity. I hope the listeners had a chance to get to know both of you a little better. I've certainly enjoyed it, and I want to thank you for all the interesting shows over the years. And, Don, I really have to kind of throw out a personal thanks to you for being my teacher and for all the guidance you've provided over the years, and also for being a wonderful butt of many jokes. I appreciate that greatly. So, Steve, I'll give it back to you to close, and thank you, listeners, for letting me be here.
And we've just heard the voice of Stan Yanchis, our guest host for Keeping the Faith this week, while he was talking with me and Don Nolan, who've tried to host this show for the last 13 years or so. Coming up next week, we'll be talking about Church World Service Hunger Programs here on Keeping the Faith. The following week, March 18, The Religious Case for Gay Rights with Jay Michelson. March 25th, School Safe Zones in Kenya with Professor Esther Portnoy. Those are some of the programs coming up ahead on Keeping the Faith. Let me say again, the University of Hawaii has a very interesting art display in its main lounge right now. And Friday Forum, Professor Robert McKim will be speaking at Friday Forum, March 9 at noon at the Y. He's Professor of Religion and Philosophy at the University of Illinois. This is part of their series on creative approaches to global development. And again, let me mention that a very important event is happening here in the Champaign-Urbana area with the construction of the first Hindu temple in this part of central Illinois. And construction will begin in April, and they're doing one last huge fundraising dinner on March 17 at the I Hotel in Champaign, 6 p.m. March 17, that's St. Patrick's Day evening. $100 a ticket to help raise money for the new Hindu temple. You may find out how to get tickets by calling 217-367-1160. That's 367-1160. Thanks for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.